This episode of New Politics was released on the 1st of April, 2023, and produced on the land of the Wangal and Whadjuk people.
Welcome to New Politics. In this episode, we give a wrap-up of the New South Wales election from last weekend. The case against whistleblower Richard Ball continues, but it needs to stop. Social housing policy and freedom of information. And we look at what might happen in the Aston by-election. I'm Eddie Djokovic, editor of New Politics.
I'm David Lewis, poet and dreamer, just trying to make my way in this crazy, crazy world.
And a big hello to the mayor of Strathfield, Karen Pensabini. Thanks for being a big supporter of the New Politics podcast, and thanks for listening in. And if you'd like to support New Politics, you can support us through a Patreon subscription, but whether it's a subscription or whether you just want to listen in, read our material online or buy a t-shirt or buy a book, it's all available at newpolitics.com.au, and all of this is a good way to support independent journalism. There was a change of government in New South Wales last weekend, and while we're still not sure if it's going to be in majority or minority, the Labor Party is the only major party which can form government, which means that it's the end of the New South Wales Liberal National Coalition after 12 years in office. But it's more than just the end of 12 years in office. Out of the 9 jurisdictions all across Australia, there's only one Liberal Party government, and that's in Tasmania. And the former Prime Minister, John Howard, he suggested that it's just a matter of time before the Liberal Party returns as a political force, but this is just empty rhetoric. These words have no meaning unless they can be backed up with evidence and action. And it looks like there are some very big long-term problems for the Liberal Party, not just in New South Wales, but all across Australia.
Of course, John Howard is going to say that it's a lull and will come back. It's almost his job as a revered, not by me, but a revered ex-leader of the party to continue to G up the troops. And Guy Rundle pointed out that if you look at Howard's strengths and even good points, he's never stopped defending the Liberal Party, even when he was stabbed in the back by his very best friends. This is a paraphrase of what Rundle said. When lesser people would have justifiably left the party, he got up the next morning and went out swinging for the party. So I wasn't surprised when Howard said that, but it is a bit optimistic, I think, is the nicest way of putting it. The only Liberal Party in government is the Tasmanian Liberal Party, and they're not the dry neoliberal party of, say, New South Wales or Victoria. They haven't been infiltrated by bizarre cults. They are led by relatively competent people. Now, it's not to say that if you're in Tasmania, you should go out and vote for them next election, or that they've done an especially good job for our listeners in Tasmania who are about to start frothing at the mouth. But it does mean that it's a different style of party. It's closer to the pre-Howard party, an Andrew Peacock style or a Malcolm Fraser style or even a John Hewson style party. And Hewson was part of that dry neoliberalism, but understood that government had a bigger role than just cutting and carving it up and giving it all away to your mates, at least in retrospect. We've said it before, Western Australia, total wipeout. Total wipeout. There's no coming back from that. Queensland, pretty much a total wipeout, will probably be saved by the National Party. Victoria, it's a total, total mess, and actually really upsetting as a lover of democracy in Australia to see how the Victorian Party has gone in the last couple of weeks is deeply upsetting. And of course, the boy blunder, Dominic Perrottet, had no chance of winning. I don't care what News Corp say. I don't care what Fairfax say. I don't care what the ABC said. He had absolutely no chance of winning. So we find ourselves with wall-to-wall Labor governments. This won't lead to a socialist paradise, of course. Like most governments until recently, they will do some good things. They will do some bad things. They'll do a lot of stuff that just is and is neither really good nor bad. And it has deep implications for the future political history of Australia.
And as you predicted, David, the result almost replicated the federal election from last year. A large crossbench, the New South Wales Labor Party winning the most seats, and the New South Wales Coalition too far behind to be able to form any sort of government at all. New South Wales Labor will probably end up being one or two seats short of a majority, so it will more than likely have to stitch up support with the New South Wales Greens or one or two of the independents. And Labor also ended up with 54.4% of the two-party preferred vote, which is close to the final news poll opinion poll, and it's also the highest ever two-party preferred vote without forming a majority government. So there are some quirks in the New South Wales electoral system at the moment. There were large swings in Liberal heartland seats, especially on the north shore of Sydney. John Barilaro's old seat of Monaro was lost to the Labor Party. So even though Labor is likely to govern from a minority position, it's returned to office after 12 years and it should be able to consolidate into the future as well, considering that New South Wales has traditionally been a Labor state. And there have been some suggestions that governing in minority won't be very good for the Labor Party, but it will probably result in better legislation, and that of course depends on who holds the balance of power, but it might bring in some much-needed reforms on gambling in New South Wales and restrictions on coal mining. Labor is quite timid on reforming these areas, but it might be forced to do something about it because of the pressure and the deals made by the crossbench, whether that's independents or New South Wales Greens. But ultimately, that would be a good thing for New South Wales, and I think it would also be a good thing for the Labor government.
The Labor campaign wasn't a terribly good campaign. And I'll acknowledge too, and hello to all our Labor members out there, we love you too. I acknowledge that in a media system dominated by anti-Labor management, it's very hard for the Labor Party in opposition to make any headway at all. I think too that what we saw was a fairly uninspiring campaign that didn't bode well for one seat or two for a Labor government. But in all fairness, having seen some of Chris Minns' speeches and having heard the Treasurer, there's the potential there for them to grow into a very good and even great government. Whether that'll happen or not, I don't know. But certainly some of the right noises are being made. And I think it's important that I acknowledge that having been very hard on them, that there's potential there for them to be much better than it looked like during the campaign.
And also a good campaign is a winning campaign, and the Labor Party ended up winning the election essentially. And I think that people might be sick of us banging on about the media, but we kept on being told that the election result was going to be close and that there was even a possibility that the Labor leader, Chris Minns, was in danger of losing his own seat. And this was almost a reflection of the media performance in the Victoria election in November last year, when the mainstream media kept on saying that the election was going to be close and that Premier Daniel Andrews was going to lose his own seat, only for Victoria Labor to go on to win twice as many seats as any other party, and Daniel Andrews winning his seat quite comfortably. It was a similar story in New South Wales. Chris Minns received a massive 20% swing towards him. The Labor Party was miles ahead of everyone else in terms of votes, in terms of seats and two-party preferred voting. And sure, you could argue, well, they didn't win the majority, but they were the only party which could form a government. And I don't think that an election that is called by Anthony Green at 8:40 on election night is actually a close election. And that brings up that whole point about horse race journalism. And that's a term that was first mentioned by the US academic Jay Rosen back in 2010. And that's when politics reported like a sport. And this is what sport commentators do to spice up a one-sided contest, even when one side is 10 goals down and there's just a few minutes of the game left to go. And as it was in Victoria, none of the opinion polls suggested that the election was going to be close. And you could argue that a minority government suggested it was a close race, but it's not close when there's only one party that can actually form government. So once again, the public is poorly served by the one-sided media coverage of politics. And in the case of the ABC, which keeps getting this all horribly wrong, there are no consequences for this continuously poor performance and poor reporting. And the ABC's 7:30 program, that's supposedly the ABC flagship current affairs program, they couldn't even be bothered reporting on the election result on the Monday. And this is Australia's biggest state and second biggest electoral event after federal elections. And it was almost like, well, our team lost, so we're not going to talk about it anymore. And just to extend that sporting analogy, it's a little bit like a sports program deciding not to report on the result of the grand final because it was not the result that they were after.
Or, you know, 100-0 thumping of their team, it was pretty close. They were in it till the end, and the coach was clearly Sterling and the people don't know what they're missing. But we're at a point too where I think, to sort of change tack a little bit, the Liberal Party is dead. And that, as a political historian, that does not fill me with glee. It's the end of an era that really started in 1943 with the election drubbing that they received in 1943. A small group of people, including future Prime Minister Robert Menzies, reformed the party, rethought what the party was about. And, of course, the United Australia Party was bereft with corruption issues, being too close to big business, losing touch with the people, not really having any policies. And you had a very energised and extremely capable Labor Party led by one of the few prime ministers who you could truly call great in John Curtin, a man who grew into the role and who should be a model for all prime ministers. The other great was his successor, Ben Chifley. After then, you get some very good ones and down the line to Morrison-esque.
Well, that's devolution in action.
You can see the decline in the party from Howard to Abbott, slight bump with Turnbull to Morrison, each one worse than the other for different reasons, but certainly each one worse than the other. The difference in 1943 is that the UAP did have the remarkable intellect and leadership skills of Robert Menzies. I don't see any figure like that in the current Liberal Party. Now, that's not to say that that person doesn't exist. I just don't see it. And if our listeners have an idea of who might be able to lead the Liberal Party out of this, I would welcome those suggestions. But it's certainly not Peter Dutton. Peter Dutton is like Billy Hughes, who was the leader of the UAP. Hughes had been Prime Minister in 1917, and they were so bereft of talent in 1941 when Menzies steps down as Prime Minister, they turned to Hughes. It would be the RAF equivalent of them turning back to Tony Abbott, really, which has been suggested.
Well, that could always be on the cards, as ridiculous as that sounds. But
yeah.
But just getting back to New South Wales, so New South Wales Labor does have that habit of returning to office through a narrow margin, and that was the case when Neville Ran became Premier in 1976, and then the same for Bob Carr in 1995, and that was before both of them went on to consolidate a long period in office for the Labor Party. And looking at the history of New South Wales, that's likely to happen again. And we did mention before that the former Prime Minister, John Howard, he did say, it's not to worry, the Liberal Party will be back soon as a force in politics. And some of our listeners have asked us to compare the current situation with what happened in 2007, which is the last time Labor had such a complete domination of politics nationally, when they were in office in every government all around Australia. And just to do some comparisons, in 2007, Labor held 60% of all seats across Australia, and that's federally, in the states and in the territories as well. And they also had 53% of votes in two-party preferred terms. And looking at it today, when you combine all of the recent elections, the seats and the votes are not that different. Labor holds 56% of all seats across Australia and has 54% of all votes in two-party preferred terms, and the only difference really is that the Liberal Party still holds in Tasmania. So these statistics seem fairly similar, but the big difference, I think, is the depth of these votes and where they're actually coming from. Younger voters are heavily favouring the Labor Party, and there's also more moderate Liberals who are voting for Teal or like-minded independents, and it's not likely that any of these will be coming back anytime soon. So back in 2007, when all the governments were held by Labor all across Australia, the WA election in 2008, that was 9 months later, that was won by the Liberal Party. And pretty soon, the pendulum started swinging the other way. So it's hard to see it now, but the dynamics of politics can change quite quickly. But I think the big difference is that Although these statistics seem quite similar between 2007 and 2023, the hole that the Liberal Party is in at the moment is a lot deeper now than what it might have been back in 2007.
Yeah, I don't know that there's any coming back without major policy reform. And of course, the promise of neoliberal economics that in the long run, everyone will be better off. And in fact, in many ways, we're not better off. We don't feel better off. The system failed. Sydney in particular is the most tolled city in the world. It's the second most expensive city to buy in the world after Hong Kong. If you're trying to buy property, there's a rental crisis because of a whole range of reasons. Public transport is shot. The health system is absolutely shot. The education system is shot. And the public have said enough is enough. And hopefully there are some smart people in, I'll call on the right of politics, who understand that a different approach to get some of those broader aims of individuality and entrepreneurship and helping people out of poverty, etc., through encouraging them to use their own, none of which have really worked in the past, though they, I'll be fair, they have worked for some people. But that reform of the party to make it not just superficially, but deep reform that becomes more appealing to voters, dumping the notion that the market is the sole solution to everything.
Well, it's almost like the Liberal Party has to become the Liberal Party of the 1960s for its future success.
I think so. I think it needs to go back to that Keynesian approach. Now, Keynes is probably dated in many ways, and so you need new economic thinking that comes out of Keynesianism. Menzies was one of the biggest Keynesian economists we'd ever had. It's the infrastructure, with the argument being that businesses use roads, businesses pay tax for roads, the roads help business do business, etc. It's good to have a healthy populace because healthy populaces can work better and be better for the economy. It's good to have a national broadcaster so that everybody has access to it. The government should supply inclusive services so that everybody who needs those services can get those services. And really, that's this type of thinking that the Liberal Party has to come to terms with. It's about pre-selections. The pre-selections around were just terrible. A lot of lunatics, a lot of, as we've seen in Victoria, some very worrying people in Victoria. Probably same here too, they're just a bit quiet here in New South Wales. Using it as a grazing field for the unemployable elite was not good either. It'll be good for the Liberal Party, and having strong parties will be good for Australia and each individual state.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through Spotify, YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or you can find us at newpolitics.com.au. And you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
The case against whistleblower Richard Boyle is proceeding after the judge in the case decided that he's not immune from prosecution and the case should now proceed. And this is the case where Richard Boyle blew the whistle on the way that the Australian Taxation Office was aggressively pursuing debts from vulnerable people and small businesses that were on the verge of collapse. And this has gone on for far too long, since 2018, and we have to remember that the Taxation Office also offered Richard Boyle a payout with no admission of liability as long as he kept quiet about it. But he decided that the practices by the Taxation Office were so bad that the public needed to know what was happening. Now, the Labor government has been in office for almost a year. They promised to clean up the whistleblower legislation and they still haven't done that. And if the Australian Taxation Office was prepared to not proceed with the case in 2018, the Attorney General, Mark Dreyfus, needs to act now and stop this case from going ahead any further.
Richard Boyle did exactly the right thing at great personal cost. It shouldn't have been at the personal cost that he has suffered. He's facing life in prison, which for a person who was doing what not only was ethically the right thing to do, but legally the right thing to do, in that you report wrongdoing if you see it. It doesn't bode well for a government that wants to clear up whistleblower legislation and doesn't start here and get rid of all of those cases.
And there are quite a few cases at the moment. And the lawyers for Richard Boyle, they were seeking immunity under the Public Interest Disclosure Act. And this is an act that was actually introduced by Mark Dreyfus when he was previously the Attorney General in 2013. So this is his act, and it's pretty clear that if the actions of Richard Boyle are not exempt from immunity, well, that act is not working the way that it was intended to work. And the public prosecutor has already reduced the number of charges in this case from 66 down to 24. Mark Dreyfus did drop the charges against Bernard Collaery and Witness K last year. He's the senior legal officer in the country, and he does have the discretion to drop this case as well. And in the past, David, we've given the Attorney General the benefit of the doubt, suggesting that there might be some unintended consequences by dropping the case at this stage, causing legal problems in other cases by setting a precedent that they don't want to set. And sure, we realise that public servants are there to do the job that they are asked to do, even if they don't like the job that they're being asked to do. But in this case, the Australian Taxation Office was behaving unethically, immorally, and illegally, and it was right for them to be called out. And the fact that the Australian Taxation Office was prepared to not proceed with the case back in 2018, I just don't think that there are any further reasons to continue with the case against Richard Boyle.
And it's not even if it's this government that did this. It was the last government. So there's no loss of face here. So I'm wondering what the strategy is, except that they want to keep whistleblowers for malfeasance on their own side under control. And I hope that's wrong. I hope that there's a whole range of reforms going on and policy rewrites going on about how this stuff should happen. But it seems that in this case, it's more of the same. And that's the type of thing that the public don't like. When they vote for change, they want change.
And as we suggested last week, the government and the Australian Greens reached a compromise on the Safeguard Mechanism climate bill, and it's allowed the Greens to announce that this amended mechanism will deter new coal and gas projects, but the government has also claimed that it won't deter new investments in the future. So it looks like everyone's getting a bit of what they both want, but they'll have different messages to give out to different audiences. And the amended Safeguard will commence on July the 1st and reduce baseline emissions by 4.9%. So that's the most important part of this legislation. So one piece of legislation is sorted out, but then another one arises. The Labor government's social housing policy is on the back burner at the moment. And the idea is that they set up a future housing fund of $10 billion. And the proceeds of around $500 million per year will be spent on 30,000 social housing properties all across Australia. Now, that sounds like a big number, but to put this into context, that's an average of two properties in each suburb and locality all across Australia. And in the context of 650,000 social housing projects that are needed, this is a serious shortfall. And the Greens have suggested that this is not enough. And they've also argued that there should be direct funding rather than funding from the proceeds from an investment fund. So the legislation's being stalled for the time being. And the Labor Party did campaign strongly about social housing during the last federal election. Jim Chalmers did suggest that it would offer a boost to the economy as well as address a serious housing supply issue. But so far, it doesn't look like it's going to be the panacea that he suggested. And this is the time to do this properly. You've got the Liberal Party in a deep hole, you're riding high in the polls, and you've got the Greens, who can be your friend in the Senate on this. So the Labor government should be doing a lot more on social housing at this point of time.
I'd have thought that social housing would have been a cornerstone of any Labor policy. Anthony Albanese himself has spoken movingly on his pride how his mother was in council housing growing up and how it helped him see injustice and influence his decisions to become ultimately Prime Minister. To base the funding on investment, to me, is insane. It's like trying to make a promise without making a promise, because investments go bad. There's too much uncertainty. So to base it on investment, and even the usually pretty decent investors of the Australian government, to me, was really giving them a get-out clause that social housing is way too important to rely on. I think they should just fund the $650,000 shortfall. In terms of what it would do to the economy, someone has to build that stuff or at least renovate it. Someone has to maintain it. Shops and schools and police stations and service providers will have to be put into those areas. In Sydney, we've seen the problem with poorly thought through development. Smaller hospitals are filled to capacity every night, and emergency surgery is being delayed because there's just not the staff to be able to cover everything. And that's because they're overdeveloped in private housing. And despite all that, there's a rental shortage. We live in weird times. To build those 650,000 residences where they're needed would do wonders for the economy. Look at what the school halls did for the economy. We avoided the global financial crisis in part due to every school in Australia getting a brand new school hall. There were still people whinging about it. We don't have to use it. Its point was that 25 or 30 people who in the area who had to build it, who then made more money, who then invested that money or who spent that money in local shops, the brick suppliers, the mortar suppliers, the electricians, the plumbers, the plumbing suppliers, the electrical supply, everybody benefited because it all floated around.
And 15 years later, those school halls are still there.
Still there, still being used by most of the schools, and a great addition. So imagine what housing would do. We've got a homelessness crisis. We have a generation of women living in cars who are over 60. Imagine what putting someone into a subsidized rental from their car would do for mental health. There are so many benefits from this. I don't understand why they aren't pursuing it with the tenacity they've pursued other deals and other court cases.
Well, the Liberal Party has said an outright no to the legislation. They won't support it, but that's no real surprise. At the moment, they're saying no to absolutely everything, even in those areas where they were actually meant to say yes. And they've said that they won't support this legislation because it won't solve affordable housing immediately. Well, unless you're making a house out of Lego bricks in someone else's backyard, nothing can be solved immediately in this sort of situation. You need to spend a few years developing this sort of stuff. Senator David Pocock has suggested a $20 billion fund, and that's doubling the $10 billion that was announced by Labor, with no ceiling on the amount that can be used each year from the fund. The Greens are arguing for direct funding rather than funding based on investment money, and they've used figures from last year to suggest that if this housing fund existed in the last financial year, well, it wouldn't have earned any money at all, and that's based on the share markets dropping 5% and superannuation funds dropping by 4% during 2022. So these are all valid arguments to put forward, but aside from social housing, overall, housing policy does need to be addressed. There does need to be a national approach because it's almost impossible when it's the states and local councils that have their own policies, which are usually at odds with federal policies. And there has been some consolidation by state governments and local councils over the past 20 years or so, but some academics are suggesting that the current problems in housing across Australia relates to colonisation from 1788 onwards, but you know, there was also that idea there was empty land that could just spread out all over the place, and that hasn't worked out so well for Australia. But there are other issues that could be considered here, the tiny house concept or smaller properties, development of villages and smaller urban communities. But all of these ideas could be included or negotiated by the Australian Greens. National Shelter has suggested that the Labor government's plan is on the table. It's a start and it should be supported rather than knocked back. But it looks like it's going to be another one of those pieces of legislation that the Greens and Labor will negotiate, either offer a better deal within housing or offer a better deal in some other related area and win out in other ways.
The Greens are growing as political negotiators. I think that's fair to say. A couple of Greens were very, very angry that the party would agree to some of these measures. And I do get that. But I think there's been a bit of learning suggesting that if you say no to everything, you get nothing. Whereas something that can be built on and evolved is better than nothing that can't be. So I think that's important to note. The Greens are, you know, depending on your view, either turning into the bastards they're trying to keep honest or are learning to work in a constructive way that probably helps ensure their long-term future rather than becoming screaming irrelevant.
Well, they're probably looking across the parliament and looking at the Liberal Party, and they're opposing absolutely everything. Mm. And they're thinking, well, we can't be like that. We're not in that situation. We don't want to become irrelevant. We want to become relevant.
Yeah. That's to be acknowledged and probably commended. I'm not sure that the hard decisions which go against policy have come through yet, but they're still in a position where they can say no to, no, this is absolutely anathema to our beliefs. So we can say no to that. So saying yes to things that tend to support their beliefs is a good thing.
You're listening to New Politics. You can subscribe to us on Apple or Google Podcasts, listen through Spotify, YouTube, SoundCloud and Amazon Music, or you can find us at newpolitics.com.au. And you can now support New Politics through Patreon.
The Australian Greens, the entire crossbench and the coalition have created an inquiry into the Freedom of Information system, and I think it's a little bit rich for the coalition to call for this considering they're the ones who actually destroyed the current system. But reforming the Freedom of Information system can only be good for the public interest. Almost 600 Freedom of Information requests have been in limbo for at least the past 3 years. And there's almost 50 requests that haven't been addressed after 5 years. And of course, there has to be a system of reducing frivolous and vexatious requests. And one of those, I think, is the one pursued by former Senator Rex Patrick in being able to view the Prime Minister's diaries. But it can be quite expensive to make a Freedom of Information request. And the system does need to be cleaned up quite a lot.
Again, good government is transparent government. Some things do need to be kept out of the public eye. Individual salaries of middle managers and below. Commercial in confidence to a small extent. I think you can go too far with it and has been used by governments in the past to really just promote rotting within the system. Military logistics maybe as things that you mightn't want too public. And also criminal investigations and medical records. That type of thing. There's some stuff that shouldn't. But when it comes to public expenditure, when it comes to policy decisions, when it comes to who is involved and what's happening and who does this type of thing benefit, if it's not open, you can only assume that there's something terribly wrong with it, because if there was nothing wrong with it, they'd be happy to share it. So this is why the FOIs are really important. You also have the notion of sometimes FOI does involve the person directly, and so getting access to files that have affected them in some kind of way is really important. So there probably should be some kind of charge on FOI to discourage frivolity, but it should be the type of thing that doesn't need to be used much but is available when required and accessible when required.
Oh, absolutely. And this is also one of the areas that the Greens could push for in their negotiations with the government on the social housing policy, improving freedom of information for the public. That's definitely an area that they could demand from the Labor government. And this is also a system that was created in 1982 by the Fraser government. So it was pretty strange for the Abbott government, which was supposedly inspired by libertarian and anti-government philosophy, to then go on and restrict opportunities for the public to see what sort of things their government was getting up to. So the public does have a right to know what type of information a government keeps about its citizens and how it came to certain decisions in office as well. And having a high quality, fair, equitable and robust freedom of information system is a sign of a healthy democracy, and it gives the public confidence in the actions of government as well. And even though the current freedom of information system is quite flawed, if we didn't have it in place, the work of journalists such as Ronnie Salt and Jommy T in exposing the secret ministries of Scott Morrison might not have been possible. And if we didn't have that material available to us, well, we'd probably all be thinking that Scott Morrison was just some idiot former prime minister sitting on the backbench instead of the mini tin pot dictator that he was on the verge of becoming. So it is important to have a strong freedom of information system in place, even if the government of the day doesn't like the idea of it.
Yeah. you're going to get caught out. You just have to accept that you're going to get caught out. So you improve your behavior so you get caught out less than perhaps you might have had you not. Things happen and decisions get made that in the cold light of day, or maybe we should have gone the other, mistakes happen, all of that. It's not all about corruption and incompetence, but it is about making sure that people know why decisions were made. And sometimes even when you know that it was a dumb decision made on a day where nobody was thinking right, that does make things a bit easier for you to cope with. And it also makes it easier for things to be repaired and reformed. So AUKUS treaty comes through as something that a good FOI might clear out. But again, you bite down on it, you accept it, you fix it, and you move on. And I'd have thought that a government that is promising change and is promising improvement, and I'll be fair, has delivered this in a lot of cases, doesn't want to deliver it all the way around.
There have been suggestions that the Aston by-election on Saturday is Peter Dutton's last stand. Historically, it's a seat that the Liberal Party should hold. They've held it for over 30 years. But when you look at much of the evidence at the moment, it's also a seat that Labor should win, and it would not be a surprise if they actually do. So there's a 2.8% margin. The Liberal Party in Victoria is in disarray, and the support for the Liberal Party has flattened since the last federal election in May 2022 and the Victoria election in November last year. And there were also all those dramas in the Liberal Party last week where the leader, John Pesutto, tried to expel Moira Deeming for her involvement in an anti-trans rally a few weeks ago and that relationship that she seems to have cultivated with neo-Nazis, and that expulsion failed and didn't actually proceed. The former Labor Party strategist, Cos Samaras, he suggested that the Liberal Party is out of touch with the community on trans rights, and he wrote that the Liberal Party should leave these Australians alone or get smashed at the ballot box. And it seems that the more the Liberal Party attacks the trans community, the more they're actually attacking themselves. So that's a separate side issue, I guess. So all of this is a continuing recipe for disaster, and it's not looking very good for the Liberal Party at the moment.
The Liberal Party, I think, pre-selected the wrong person. And in that, I'm not talking about her abilities or her positive attributes to what she might do for Aston, but she's married to a News Corp editor, James Campbell. I think that that just sends the wrong message, that the Liberal Party was not prepared to change. It should have been a local, a strong local, certainly female, person of colour perhaps, but they could have sent a message that the party was changing and was listening. They've picked the wrong person.
Well, I guess the other point is that just because Roisin Campbell is married to a newspaper editor, it shouldn't preclude her from running in that seat. But the issue is that the newspaper editor is from News Corporation, and that does send out the wrong message, as you suggested, David.
Yeah, a woman should be able to do a job without her husband being a factor. But this is a special case. News Corp is not popular in Victoria, and it's less so in Melbourne. The people of Melbourne remember how News Corp behaved during the pandemic and how they treated the Premier. I think the talk is that Mary Doyle might win it. It's really anybody's game, except I think I can wipe out Roisin Campbell.
Well, this one is quite an unusual by-election, and the focus itself isn't so much on the seat of Aston, and Aston is on the outer edge of eastern Melbourne, but the focus seems to be on how the result will affect politics outside of Aston. And if the Liberal Party win, well, they'll see that as a vindication of their campaign on cost of living issues and their first step back to electoral relevance, and they'll claim all of this whether they win the seat by one vote or 10,000 votes. So a win in the seat is absolutely critical for the Liberal Party and for the leadership of Peter Dutton. And if the Labor Party wins, well, that's good for them. A political party will always like to take a seat off their opponents, whether it's at a general election or at a by-election. And if they do win, it would add to that little buffer that they gained at the last election. And if Labor doesn't win the seat, well, they can claim that no government has ever won a seat off an opposition since 1921. They haven't held the seat for over 30 years, and it was previously a safe Liberal Party seat, so they can bring up all of those issues. But if the Liberal Party lose the seat, it's an absolute disaster for them. All of those dramas in the Liberal Party over Moira Deeming during the past week have come at the wrong time. They've also got a federal leader who has kept a low profile during the Aston by-election. And sure, Peter Dutton's been there four times during the election campaign, but he hasn't really had much of a profile there. And there's an odd situation where Peter Dutton didn't campaign at all during the Victoria election last year. He didn't campaign at all during the New South Wales election this year. He has kept a low profile during the Aston by-election. So you think, well, what are you going to do during a federal election campaign? You can't just have Peter Dutton campaigning in Queensland, and that's his home state, and the Liberal National Party holds 21 of the 30 seats up there. So they can't have him just campaigning in Queensland and then hide him from all the other states all around Australia. That's not really a winning formula. So if the Liberal Party does lose Aston, this is probably going to be the lowest point the Liberal Party can reach at the moment. And also, if they can't learn or see all the lessons that they've been given by the electorate over the past 3 years, plus all of those endless pieces of advice that we've been providing to the Liberal Party, David, they probably never will learn those lessons ever again.
In a federal election, if your federal leader isn't a part of the campaign, it's a problem, isn't it? If there was a by-election in a Labor seat, say, and if Anthony Albanese didn't show up, you'd write the seat off. And, you know, if one of those Green seats, if Adam Bent doesn't show up, even in pitches, there may be that the schedule doesn't allow the Prime Minister to turn up to a campaign over 4 weeks because overseas trips and meetings and what have you. But you'd want at least a picture showing the endorsement of the leader and everyone saying, well, yes, he or she is the leader of the party. They must be a good candidate because they've put the picture up. It's just insane that they would run a federal election campaign and try and ignore the person who they want to lead them federally. And I think that probably says it all about Peter Dutton's leadership. I don't know that it will finish his leadership because it's the first by-election, but it will make the next one a bit harder, and at the moment there are no safe Liberal seats. After Kooyong and North Sydney and all of those other previously safe Liberal seats, and a lot of the ones that survived are marginal, close to marginal now, the next by-election just makes it that much harder, and then the next one that much harder again. If I was Peter Dutton, I'd be having a good, hard look at myself and working out whether this is really the job for me. And whether I'm destined to be Prime Minister, because no one's going to fall over and let you cross the line like they did with Morrison. And you can't do that from opposition anyway. And the opposition is too weak to be able to outflank the government. So we have these disgraceful displays of not turning up to hear the legislation to the voice to Parliament being read, running out of the building to prevent votes going to the COVID legislation. It's a party in disarray. It's a party of rabble. It's a party that's not confident, that lacks direction, that lacks leadership. And Peter Dutton may be the nominal leader, but he's not leading. And that's probably the first thing they'd have to do to get serious reform in, get rid of the leader.
That's it for this episode of New Politics. Thanks for listening in. And if you'd like to support our style of journalism and commentary, please make a donation at our website at newpolitics.com.au. We don't beg, plead, beseech or gaslight you about journalism coming to an end. We just keep it very simple. If you like what we do, please send some support our way. It keeps our commitment to independent journalism ticking along. I'm Eddie Djokovic. Thanks for listening in, and it's goodbye to our listeners.
I'm David Lewis. We'll see you next time.